So perhaps then a sheep has fallen down a hole, and it's your task to lift that sheep out of the hole. Then again, perhaps there's an elderly lady who's frail and she's lying in bed and she wants to get up, and you're helping her out of bed and to her feet. And again, perhaps you're working on behalf of the authorities and you've been tasked with arresting somebody whom the authorities want to detain. Then again, perhaps, and I hope you would never be in this situation, but perhaps somebody owes you money and you are throttling that person to within an inch of their life in order to get them to pay the money they owe you. What do all those situations have in common? Well, in all of them, they require a serious use of the hands. They require a tight grip, whether it's to get purchase on that sheep that you're lifting out of the hole, whether it's to stop the elderly lady from falling back onto the bed again, whether it's to pin down this person that you're in the process of arresting, whether it's to block the windpipe of the person you're throttling. Limp-handedness is no good in any of those situations. All of them require a tight grip. And the reason I'm beginning on that note then is that here in our text this morning, we have a word. It's the word translated here in the ESV, hold fast, there in verse 14. And that same Greek word is used elsewhere in the New Testament in precisely those four contexts that I've just mentioned. It's used of lifting a sheep out of a pit. It's used of Jesus helping Peter's mother-in-law out of her bed. It's used of authorities in many occasions, actually, especially authorities sending people to arrest Jesus himself. It's used of the seizing of Jesus. And it's used of the unmerciful servant seizing his debtor and trying to throttle him. And here then, it's used in our text. But of course, here it's been used metaphorically. It's not literally gripping something with your hands, with your actual fingers, that it's talking about, because the thing being gripped here, the thing being held fast, is our confession. What is our confession? Well, that means then the core truths which we as Christians believe. The central tenets of our Christian faith, the fundamental facts and doctrines of Christianity. That's what is meant by our confession. And of course, you can't literally grip that like you can grip a sheep that's in a pit. But what the writer is saying then is keep believing those facts and doctrines. Keep being 100% committed to them. Maintain the tightest possible grip on the faith that you as Christians have subscribed to. Those doctrines that at conversion you assented to and that became part of the fabric of your whole thinking and you began to build your life on them, those great central core fundamentals of Christianity, the writer is saying, don't let them go. Whatever you do, keep tight grip of them. Of course, it's not inevitable, is it, that that should happen? Some people don't keep a tight grip on the core truths of Christianity. Think of a famous athlete from our own city, Jonathan Edwards. Hasn't kept a tight grip, hasn't held fast his confession. The footballer Glenn Hoddle once appeared on Christian videos and Christian tracts confessing the truths of Christianity. He hasn't kept a tight grip. the singer Bob Dylan, and releasing albums in the early 1980s, just packed full of wonderful gospel lyrics. He hasn't kept a tight grip of his confession. They're all famous people, but we all know people. We can all think of people in our families, perhaps, in our social circle, people who once were part of this church, perhaps, who didn't keep a tight grip, who didn't hold fast their confession. And it's that then that the writer is saying we must do. We must hold fast our confession. I just want to notice then three things. And first of all this morning this, why we hold fast our confession. Why we hold fast our confession. So we've all then, or some of us perhaps, have had political views which over the years have changed. Perhaps our musical taste has changed over the years. Perhaps our sporting allegiances have changed. We used to support one football team and we support a different one today. Now, none of those is a big deal, is it? It's not a big deal that our political views have changed, our musical taste, our sporting allegiance. Then again, perhaps some of us have changed our position on some Christian things, but things that are outside of the core truths of the gospel, our confession, as our writer calls it here. Perhaps we've changed our views, our position on baptism or on Bible versions. And again, it's not insignificant, but it's not a massive deal. And yet, when at times in our lives when we've come close, perhaps, to giving up on Christianity altogether, people have really pleaded with us passionately. At times when we've seen others giving up on Christianity altogether, we have wept over them. So what's the difference then? Why can we change in all sorts of other ways and it's not a big deal, but we must hold fast the Christian gospel? Or to put the question another way, what's so great about the Christian gospel? What's so great about our Christian confession? What's so great about the central message of Christianity that makes it so indispensable? That means that even if we change everything else about our thinking and our lives, we mustn't exchange that for anything. What's so great about it? Well, let me point out two things. First of all, it addresses guilt. It addresses guilt. Notice what the writer says in verse 14. Since then, we have a great high priest. We have a high priest. That's central to Christianity. That's a part of the Christian confession. We have a high priest. And the whole point, you see, of a high priest is to do something about guilt. That's why you have a high priest. If guilt didn't exist, there would be no need for high priests. The whole point of a high priest is to do something about guilt. Think of a lifeboatman. And the whole point of a lifeboatman is to rescue people who are in trouble at sea. North Tyneside Council aren't going to decide one day, we'll build a lifeboat station in Benton. We'll put it on Hoy Lake Avenue. That would be a good idea. And yeah, okay, there's no sea around here, so they can't actually carry out any maritime rescues, but they'll be useful for other things. No, lifeboatmen aren't useful for other things. That's the point of them. They are there to rescue people from the sea. And similarly then, the point of a high priest is to do something about guilt. And so when Christianity claims, when the Christian gospel claims we have a high priest, it's claiming to address the issue of guilt. What's so great about that, you say? Well, this is what's so great about that. Your guilt is your biggest problem. Full stop. Your guilt is your biggest problem. My guilt is my biggest problem. We have politicians touring the country right now telling us passionately how, if they are voted in, they are going to address the economy, and they are going to address the NHS, and they are going to address university tuition fees, and so on. And in speaking so frequently and so passionately about these things, they are assuming that my biggest problem is the smallness of my disposable income, and so I need someone to go on about the economy. My biggest problem is the length of time I have to wait for an appointment or an operation in hospital. And so they go on about the NHS. My biggest problem is the money I have to spend for my child to go to university, and so they go on about university tuition fees. Those things aren't my biggest problem. For this reason, that 100, 150 years from now, they will be absolutely irrelevant to me. The economy, the NHS, university tuition fees, everything else that the politicians are talking about so passionately. I'm not saying that these things are insignificant in and of themselves, but compared to what we're talking about this morning, they are. 100, 150 years from now won't matter a single little bit to me. Not the same with guilt. The guilt that I've accumulated throughout my life through my repeated breaking of God's law. The guilt that I can now easily sweep under the carpets and pretend doesn't exist and pretend isn't an issue because I'm on earth and God is in heaven and I haven't yet come face to face with Him. Once I leave this world and do come face to face with Him, as inevitably I must, then that will be an issue, all right. When my health and my income and all these other matters have receded into utter inconsequence, my guilt will be an issue, all right. Everything will depend on whether that guilt has been dealt with or not. This is a problem of huge proportions, I'm saying. You think you have perhaps lots of problems this morning. The one problem that will still be around, if it hasn't been dealt with, 100 years from now, is your guilt. And I'm saying then that Christianity addresses guilt. The Christian gospel, it doesn't just potter around with little things on the sidelines of reality. It addresses the problem that is the biggest one for all of us. It addresses guilt. But then the second reason that the Christian gospel is so great, it offers assurance. It offers assurance because, of course, the Christian gospel doesn't have a monopoly when it comes to addressing guilt. There are other religions and other ideologies that address the matter of guilt. And here then are these people to whom the letter to the Hebrews has been written. And these people, as you know then, it seems almost certain, they are Jews, hence the title of the book. They are Hebrews. But they are Jews who have been converted to Jesus Christ. But these readers then, these Christians, they have many compatriots, they have many countrymen, they have many fellow Jews who, of course, haven't been converted to Christ, who don't share their Christian confession, And they then adhere to a religious system, and it addresses guilt. And it has a high priest, actually. It has a man in Jerusalem who goes by the title of high priest. And in fact, not only does it have a high priest, but it has all kinds of other things which might seem to even give it an advantage over Christianity. It has a temple, and it has robes, and it has pomp and ceremony, and all the things that the Christianity to which these readers had been converted seemed to lack. And for that reason then, some of these readers, it seems, they are feeling drawn back. They are feeling tempted to go back to that religious system centered on Jerusalem, centered on the temple building, centered on a high priest who goes and does his stuff in that temple building. And throughout the letter then, and here in our text this morning, the writer is continually challenging his readers in this way. He's saying to them, okay, your fellow Jews, they're part of a religious system that also addresses guilt. But let me put this question to you. If you go back to them, if you join them, if you go back to the whole Jerusalem religion, if you go down that route, can you really have any assurance that your guilt has not only been addressed, but is being dealt with? That the problem of your guilt is actually being resolved? Can you have any assurance? If you throw yourselves back into that whole Levitical, sacrificial system, it's addressing guilt, all right? It's predicated on guilt being the fundamental human problem, but can you have any assurance down that road that your guilt is actually being dealt with? Well, his readers might reply, we can look at that high priest there in Jerusalem. And he's such a revered figure, an eminent man, a member of a leading Jewish family, and we can look at him in his flowing robes, and that surely gives us some assurance that our guilt is being dealt with. To which the writer of Hebrews says, big deal, big deal. Our high priest in the Christian gospel, our high priest isn't merely some revered Israelite guy with robes on. He is, what is he? Verse 14, he is Jesus, the Son of God. Who would you rather entrust your salvation to? Who would you rather entrust the resolving of your guilt to? Some guy who is from an Israelite family and happens to have the position of high priest for a while, and he wears all these robes and he performs all these ceremonies, or the Son of God, the one whom he has described in chapter 1, who is the radiance of the glory of God, the one whom all God's angels worship, the one who laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning and the heavens are the work of his hand? He's saying, who would you rather entrust your salvation to? To some guy in Jerusalem, or to Jesus, the Son of God? Okay, the readers might reply, all right then, but there's something else we can look to for our assurance. I mean, a few months ago, the high priest, it was Yom Kippur, and it was the Day of Atonement, and the high priest, he went into the temple, and he went into the Holy of Holies, and he put blood on the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, that surely, that the sheer seriousness and gravity of that ceremony, that can give us assurance that our guilt has been dealt with. And the writer says, big deal. Okay, the high priest in Jerusalem, a few months ago on Yom Kippur, he went into the temple, into the Holy of Holies, sprinkled blood. What's he doing now? He's now preparing to perform exactly the same ritual again in a few months' time. Which surely suggests that actually it didn't do anything when he did it the last time. He'll do it again, and 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 it'll be repeated over and over again, because it's not doing anything. We have a high priest who, he says, what does he say? Verse 14, who has passed through the heavens. In other words, he has offered a sacrifice with blood. But having done so, he's not now preparing for the next one. He's now gone into heaven. God has ushered him into the very court of heaven himself and enthroned him on heaven's throne as an indication that God is satisfied with that one sacrifice he has performed and requires nothing more ever again. As it's put in chapter 1, verse 3, after making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty in High, because nothing more was required. And you see then what he's saying. He's saying that our Christian gospel doesn't just address guilt, but it offers assurance that your guilt has actually been dealt with. Because it wasn't just anybody who performed the priestly activity. It was Jesus, the Son of God, and having offered his sacrifice, he sat down in heaven itself. And these then remain this morning for us compelling reasons why we should hold fast our confession. Perhaps you're being tempted this morning to even walk away from Christianity itself, to even give up on the gospel itself. And there are countless reasons why that is the most foolish and self-destructive thing you could possibly do. But here are two reasons this morning for holding fast your confession. The Christian gospel addresses your biggest problem, which is your guilt. And it not only addresses it, it gives you assurance. If you're trusting in Christ, your guilt is finished. It's dealt with. It's sorted. The Son of God has done it. And he's now seated in heaven, showing that nothing else is required. Why we hold fast our confession. More briefly, secondly, where we hold fast our confession. Where we hold fast our confession. You all know there's this reality TV program that comes on from time to time. I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. And a group of so-called celebrities then are dumped in the jungle. And it's a test of their endurance. How long can they cope without having to say, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here, without having to give up? Now, I've never seen the show, and perhaps I'm just cynical, but I suspect that they're only dumped in the jungle in the loosest possible sense. I suspect that the chances of them being attacked by a wild animal, or contracting some disease, or getting lost, it's probably fairly minimal. I suspect it's a fairly controlled environment that they are doing all this in. And so enduring is, well, perhaps a bit harder than when you're just at home in your nice comfy house, but it's not that difficult. It's such a controlled environment. Enduring that isn't hugely difficult. What about this then, this endurance to which the writer is calling us here, this holding fast of our confession? Is it easy because we're in a controlled environment? We're in a nice, comfortable zone where it's easy to hold fast our confession? Well, we're not, are we? And two words then in our text indicate that. Two words kind of leap out of the page at you in verse 15. The word weaknesses and the word tempted. That's the context in which we have to hold fast our confession. That's where we do it. Not in some nice controlled environment where it's lovely and easy. We have to do it in a context of weakness and temptation. In other words, holding fast our confession, keeping going as Christians, keeping a tight grip on the gospel itself, is hard for two reasons. Number one, because of what we are in ourselves, we are constitutionally weak and frail. And number two, because of what we face from outside of ourselves. We face situations and we face circumstances and we face possibilities that tempt us. And so for those two reasons then, it's hard, and it's a dangerous combination, weakness and temptation. It wouldn't so much matter that we are weak and constitutionally frail if there were never any temptations coming at us from outside, because that weakness would never be stretched and demanded. Then again, it wouldn't matter that we're facing temptations from outside if we were constitutionally robust and strong and supermen. But when we are both weak and being tempted, that's a hard combination. And the writer is saying that that's our situation. That, of course, is not his main point, actually, in verse 15. We'll come to what his main point is in a moment. But what it assumes, what it presupposes, is that we are, all of us, every single Christian, we are in ourselves weak, and from outside of ourselves, we are constantly being bombarded with temptation. I don't know about you, but that seems to match my situation pretty well. I can understand that. That resonates. That's where we're at, isn't it? That's the context. If we were just in a lab, in this kind of artificial environment, being called upon to hold fast our confession, that'd be a doddle. But we're not. We're in this context where it's hard, where it's really hard, because of weakness and because of temptation. So why we hold fast our confession? Where we hold fast our confession? But thirdly, and crucially then, how we hold fast our confession. If it's so hard to do because of the context we're in, how are we going to achieve it? As we said, some don't. How are we going to not end up in the category of those people I mentioned at the start of my sermon? Those who once seemed to be holding the confession that we hold this morning, but let it go. We face the same weakness and the same temptation that they did. How are we going to keep on keeping on? Well, in two ways. First of all, by understanding a fact. By understanding a fact. Let's think again about this reality that Jesus has passed through the heavens. He has entered into the presence of God now. He has ascended into glory. He is enthroned on the very highest throne of the universe. And if you like, if you want to think in terms of prepositions, there's a preposition. There's the preposition because, and that's what we were concentrating on before. He has passed through the heavens because he has offered one effective sacrifice that God is pleased with, and so God has ushered him into heaven and requires him to sacrifice no more. So there's a crucial preposition because, but there's another preposition we could use, and it's the preposition as. He has passed through the heavens, yes, because he has offered a once for all effective sacrifice. He has passed through the heavens as what? As simply the Son of God in the same form that he's always existed in from eternity? No, as Jesus the Son of God. As one who himself has experienced weakness and temptation in the process of offering that once for all sacrifice. In other words, there is someone seated on the very highest throne of the universe this morning who knows firsthand, who knows from personal intimate experience, this context that you and I are in this morning and struggling with, the context of weakness, constitutional frailty, and temptation coming at us. He knows about that. Not just because he knows everything, but he knows experientially that context. He's been there, he's inhabited it himself. So this morning, you have somebody who doesn't like you and who is mistreating you. And the temptation for you, you're tempted to retaliate and to treat that person the same way that person is treating you. And that's a powerful temptation. Jesus was tempted that way too. He was mistreated, arrested, flogged, mocked, crucified. Tempted powerfully to get his own back, lash out, retaliate, He knows what that temptation is like. This morning, perhaps you're someone who is doing well at work. You're climbing the ladder. And you're surrounded by colleagues who live for self-gratification, who live to advance themselves and to better themselves. And you're surrounded by a culture and by advertising that encourages you to live for yourself and to gratify yourself and indulge yourself. And you're tempted to throw yourself into that lifestyle. Forget all the self-discipline and the self-control of Christianity. Leave that lifestyle behind. Throw yourself into this one. Jesus was too. Think of him in the desert. Satan saying to him, look, I can give you all the kingdoms of the world. Just bow down to me and you can have the world. You can have everything. The world with all its riches, all yours. Powerfully tempted in that way. He knows what that's like. This morning, perhaps you're finding things tough. All sorts of things are going against you. There are adversities and difficulties on every side. At work, in the family, in your health, all sorts of things. And you're tempted to slip into self-pity. And the idea that God obviously doesn't care for you, otherwise you wouldn't be experiencing these circumstances. He was tempted that way too. As the crowds at Golgotha shouted out, let God rescue him now if he wants him. In other words, God doesn't really care about you. If he did, he'd take you down from this cross, wouldn't he? He knows what that temptation is like. Perhaps this morning you're facing death in the not too distant future. And you have a spouse or you have loved ones. And you're tempted to be consumed by anxiety. What's going to happen to them once you're gone? How will they cope without you? How will they fare? Jesus was tempted that way too. Dying in his early 30s. Dying on a cross, seeing his mother standing at the foot of the cross there. How vulnerable she was going to be once he had gone. He knows what that temptation's like. Perhaps this morning you're tempted by a member of the opposite sex who is attractive and is paying you some attention. But any relationship is thoroughly out of bounds because that person's married or because you're married. And you're tempted to taste the sweetness of that forbidden fruit. It's a powerful temptation. Jesus was tempted that way too. When and where, I don't know, but I know what this text says, that in every respect he has been tempted as we are, including that way. There's not a temptation that we face that Jesus has not faced. And the fact, by the way, that the writer says he was without sin, that doesn't in any way there then kind of minimize the impact of this. It surely increases it. It means that Jesus faced far more of every kind of temptation than we do. We face a little bit and then we give into it. And Satan can walk away from us then. Oh, I got you that time. Doesn't need to bother with anything else. And yet Satan, he tempts Jesus a little bit, and Jesus resists, and so he has to tempt him a bit more, and Jesus still resists, and he has to throw a few more of his stratagems at him, and Jesus still resists, and he has to ransack his entire arsenal of weaponry to tempt Jesus, and he still resists. And I'm saying that Jesus has faced every single trick that Satan knows precisely because he was without sin and wouldn't succumb. And we then face all these temptations, as we've already said, amidst weakness. We are constitutionally frail and weak. So was Jesus. We have limitations, don't we? Limited physical energy. And of course, so often temptation exploits that, doesn't it? We are more susceptible when we're tired, when we're exhausted. We're more susceptible to temptation. Jesus was often tired and exhausted. So much so, he would fall asleep on a boat during the day. We have limited knowledge. And temptation often exploits that, particularly the temptation to be worried. It exploits the fact we don't know everything that's going to happen in the future. Jesus had limited knowledge. He said that himself, that the Son of Man doesn't know when the second coming is going to take place. And that made him susceptible to temptation. We have limited mental processes. We know, don't we, that the best way of combating temptation is through this book and through absorbing it and imbibing it and getting it into our bloodstream. And yet our mental powers are limited, and we struggle in the moment of temptation to remember passages we've memorized and to recall scripture. Jesus' mental powers were limited as well. He was constitutionally frail like we are. And that frailty made him more susceptible. And so I'm saying then the first way that we hold fast our confession is understanding the fact. What's the fact then that I'm getting at here? The fact is, as the writer puts it, he sympathizes with us. Jesus sympathizes. We need to understand this, that Jesus, who now is seated on the throne, he is sympathetic toward us in our context of weakness and temptation because he himself has experienced it all. Actually, it's not just because he has experienced it all. It obviously says something about his character, doesn't it? That he is compassionate. It means Jesus is two things. He's compassionate and he's comprehending. Jesus could be compassionate toward us, and yet he's never experienced anything we've experienced, and so he can't really comprehend. Then again, Jesus could be comprehending. He's experienced everything we've experienced, but he doesn't really care about us. But no, he's both. He's compassionate and he's comprehending, and so he sympathizes with us, the writer is saying. Understand that. Jesus isn't harsh and unfeeling and uncaring as you feel that you're at your wit's end this morning. And it's so tough to keep on going as a Christian, and you're not sure you can take another step on this pilgrim road. Jesus isn't saying, oh, pull yourself together, man. He is sympathetic toward you this morning. His heart is inclined toward you this morning. He feels for you this morning. Understand this fact, that the devil will try and chase out of your head at every possible opportunity and tell you Jesus is harsh and he's too great to even remember your name this morning. No, Jesus is sympathetic. So the first way we do it, by understanding the fact, but then secondly, by developing a practice. And you all know what that is then. Let us draw near to the throne of grace. Knowing then that on that throne is Jesus Christ, who sympathizes with us. Go to him. Pray to him. And it's a... In the Greek, the tense is a present continuous. Don't just go once. Keep on going. Keep on going. Keep on going. Whenever you're tempted, whenever you're feeling your weakness, whenever you're struggling in the Christian life, whenever you're flirting with loosing your grip on your confession, go to Jesus, the sympathetic one who is on the throne. It's a throne of grace. And yes, of course, it's a throne of pardoning grace. And when we do mess up and we do sin, we can go to that throne and we can get pardon and forgiveness from it because Christ has died for our sins. But that's not the emphasis here. Not a throne of pardoning grace, but a throne of grace to help in time of need. Don't go to the throne simply when you have sinned. Go to the throne before you sin, when you're being tempted to sin. Go and ask for help to resist the temptation. Help to keep on going. Because Christ is sympathetic. He knows your situation. And he is willing to give you all the grace, all the strength, all the help you need. So often we try to battle it alone, don't we? By the strength of our willpower. And we wonder why we don't succeed. Go to Christ. In temptation, in weakness, go to Christ. And get from him, through prayer, the strength and the grace that you need. Amen.